This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. On Fridays, we break up the show into a few different topics. We call it our Friday Pitch-In. Coming up, our education reporters team up to bring us a guide on the issues and candidates who will most greatly affect education in Indiana. If you haven't voted yet and education's on your mind, you'll want to hear that one. Later, a reporter from Side Effects Public Media talks about what seasonal affective disorder might look like this year as the days get colder and shorter. And oh yeah, there's an isolating global pandemic as well. And finally, we'll hear from the Indiana brewery who won the most medals of any brewery nationwide at this year's Great American Beer Festival. But first, we'll start, as we always do on Fridays, with a recap of this week's biggest statewide stories. Lauren Chapman is our digital producer, and she's here. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. The numbers is where we all start, and it's been a rough week for numbers. It's been a rough few weeks for numbers, as I understand it. What do we know now?
Yeah, it's been a rough how long has it been since we moved to stage 5 weeks for numbers? As of noon today, 3,858 people have died from COVID-19, have confirmed to have died from COVID-19. There are more than 157,000 confirmed cases, and a little more than 1.6 million Hoosiers have been tested. Today's 2,519 new COVID cases are the third highest single day reported, behind Saturday's 2,521 and yesterday's 2,880. Over the last week, 204 deaths were reported from COVID-19, and that's back into the kind of numbers we were seeing in mid to late May. And more than 1,500 Hoosiers are hospitalized with COVID-19, which is the most since early May. We haven't had a day where we reported less than 1,000 cases since October 7th, and all of the state's guiding principles are trending in the wrong direction. In just the last week, more than 14,000 new cases have been reported, and the moving average for cases has increased by 139% since we moved into stage 5.
Wow. Is Governor Holcomb saying anything about moving back whatsoever?
No. Governor Holcomb insists there is no need to reimpose statewide COVID-19 restrictions. As I said, the moving average for cases has increased by 139% since we moved into stage 5 and withdrew almost all restrictions. At his weekly press briefing on Wednesday, the governor said the state is in a much better place than early in the pandemic. He said hospital systems aren't overwhelmed and the state's PPE supplies are sufficient. Asked multiple times about whether he would reimpose restrictions, Holcomb became really defensive. He framed the choice as being between staying in stage 5 or going back to the harshest restrictions imposed during the early days of the pandemic, which, just as a quick note, most folks who have advocated for moving the state back to previous restrictions have suggested going back to, like, stage 3 or 4 with limiting capacity in buildings, not going back to stay-at-home orders, lockdown, everything.
Okay, but at the same time, we know what works, and if people did what works, wearing masks and everything else, which a lot of the majority of people are doing, we can keep things as flat as possible. It seems, according to some, and so it's a tough thing to look at right now. Now, another thing that's happening is rising cases at nursing homes. And I understand Governor Holcomb is trying to do something about that.
Yeah. So at the same press conference, Holcomb announced the state will devote significant resources to nursing homes across Indiana for the next few weeks. COVID-19 cases and deaths are surging in nursing homes as the state infection rates are spiking as well. To respond, Holcomb said he will deploy the Indiana National Guard and members of the state's healthcare reserve workforce to help staff those facilities. Nursing homes account for more than half of Indiana's COVID-19 deaths.
We did some reporting on nursing homes recently, and we talked about the problems with visitation, and it sounds like that the restrictions on visitations were indeed necessary now that we've seen rising cases in nursing homes. It seems like they need to be much more vigilant, and we hope that the National Guard can step in and help with some of those staffing and personnel and resource issues.
Yeah.
Now, schools have always been in the conversation.
Just,
oh, go ahead,
yeah,
please.
Yeah, just to go back to, so the nursing home spikes that we're seeing, that spike is fairly parallel to, like, the base population, right? But it's in no way, shape, or form the kind of spikes that we saw at the beginning of the pandemic compared to one of the problems of, you know, looking at those graphs and looking at that data and trying to compare apples to apples from April to September and October is the testing. Nursing homes were provided more tests than the average population because they are nursing homes, long-term care facilities, are generally folks who are at-risk populations. But the spike that we're seeing in nursing homes compared to, you know, just June to now isn't necessarily the same kind of spike that we're seeing in a lot of counties across the state.
If you have relatives in a nursing home and they have the ability to visit with you virtually, please visit them. They are really, really isolated right now. It's a really, really hard time. Of course, there's a lot to worry about, COVID, but check in with your loved ones in nursing homes right now. Schools are always in the conversation when we're talking about COVID-19, and we're seeing a rise in cases right now in schools.
We're being able to we're seeing that playing out in some counties. So, for example, in Fountain and Warren counties, a spike in cases earlier this month prompted the local health department to issue new recommendations for those schools. That list included recommendations to return students to remote learning and cancel extracurricular activities for 2 weeks. Covington Community School Corporation Superintendent Kevin Smith said the constantly changing situation kind of makes it hard to provide a stable learning environment for students and staff and their families. Finding people to do things like drive buses, prepare meals, and lead classrooms gets tricky when a lot of people have to quarantine or get sick. Smith says no major disruptions had occurred this fall until his schools were suddenly forced to go back to remote learning earlier this month. One thing that's really important to note, we do parse out school data on ISDH's website, coronavirus.in.gov. But early research actually indicates that there isn't a link between school buildings reopening and widespread community outbreaks. What we're seeing is kind of a snapshot of what school systems are looking like and are able to kind of compare that to the community at large as well. At a press conference with Democratic gubernatorial candidate Dr. Woody Myers, State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick said communities need to make the connection between social distancing and mask wearing and the ability for schools to remain open. Basically, if you're not wearing your mask, if you're not social distancing, then your schools aren't going to be able to stay open.
Those things directly affect the infection rates, and if we all do our part, we can stay at in-person learning, which has been a big debate among people. Should we stay in person? Obviously, learning is better when it's in person, but amid a global pandemic, it can be difficult if cases are rising, which we are seeing. We are seeing that big second wave, as you mentioned last week. This is really more of a third or fourth wave if you look at the
This is
a full third.
I'm not a medical professional nor a data scientist, but we could call it a third.
You are the closest thing to a data scientist that I know. You really dig into the data, and that's what I love about talking to you about data. But when you look at that curve, this is really kind of the third wave. There was a small little hump of a second wave, but this is what a lot of people are calling the second wave because it's the big wave. The first wave, of course, was in the springtime. This was the big one that people said was coming this time of year. And
we're not even to the bad part of the year where people are actually driven inside more.
Indeed. Yeah. And also, it will be interesting to see what happens after the election in case some people are defending their offices and restrictions are a touchy subject. And then once everything's solidified, it'll be interesting to see if restrictions come back among people like Governor Eric Holcomb, who imposed some harsh restrictions on Indiana in the springtime. And speaking of Governor Holcomb, he defended his term at the gubernatorial debate this week.
Yeah, he defended his job performance Tuesday in the first of two gubernatorial debates. His challengers, Democrat Dr. Woody Myers and Libertarian Donald Rainwater, assailed Holcomb's record from sharply different angles is probably the easiest way to describe that.
No surprise there.
Yeah. The debate was a rapid-fire series of questions on a variety of topics, from COVID-19 to education to guns and taxes and the environment. State House reporter Brandon Smith did a really great wrap-up from the first debate, at which Myers made news right off the bat, where he announced he would appoint the current Republican State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jennifer McCormick, as Indiana's first Secretary of State. This is notable.
Secretary of Education,
right? Yes, Secretary of Education. Thank you. This is notable for two reasons. First and foremost, she's a Republican, he's a Democrat. Second, it was the first gubernatorial candidate to announce who their Secretary of Education would be. Libertarian candidate for Governor Donald Rainwater announced his choice for Education Secretary on Thursday. He said if he wins the election, he'll appoint Dawn Wooten to the post. She's a university English professor in Fort Wayne and ran against current office holder Jennifer McCormick for the Republican nomination for State Superintendent of Public Instruction in 2016.
And we have not heard anything from Governor Holcomb on who he will appoint, correct?
No, not at all.
Not yet. And we will hear a lot more about education issues in the next segment with Jeannie Lindsay and Eric Weddle. We're going to present kind of a voting guide for education issues in Indiana and what the presidential candidates stand for, what the gubernatorial candidates stand for. And we'll also look at some of the down ballot races like school board and some other statewide races in the next segment. So stay with us for that. Let's look at the Indiana 2022 way. We are getting so close to election day, which is why we built the Indiana 2022 way. But there's still plenty of interaction that we want to do with it, right?
Absolutely. Text elections to 73224 to join the Indiana 2022 way. We're still interacting with you. We're wrapping up our video series ahead of the election. I filmed the penultimate video yesterday, which is just the best 10 minutes of my week geeking out about first-time voter questions. But we're still answering your questions. We're still using those questions to drive what we're working on. So please, 73224, text elections.
She's the greatest. Ask any of us. And she got to use the word penultimate today. Lauren Chapman, thanks.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Up next, education will be on the minds of many Hoosiers at the voting booth. We will hear from two education reporters on how teachers are doing and who they're endorsing and what referendums may be on your ballot. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Education will be on the minds of many voters at the ballot box this year, whether it's electing school board candidates, voting on referendums, choosing a governor, or even a president. To help us understand what's at stake in Indiana this year, I have two education reporters, Jeannie Lindsay of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Hello, Jeannie.
Hello.
And Eric Weddle from our flagship station, WFYI in Indianapolis. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. So, Jeannie, we'll start with you. There are so many races to consider, but let's look at a big one regarding statewide education policy. Which one's that?
Yeah, it's the race for governor. So whoever wins this upcoming election will be the first person to appoint the next leader of the Department of Education. That's the position currently held by Jennifer McCormick.
It'll have a different title, right? Right now it's Superintendent of Public Instruction, used to be an elected position. Is the title of that position changing?
Yeah, so there's kind of two changes that I guess I'm looking at. So obviously the difference on how the person is chosen, you know, previously people would elect that person just like they would for governor. State lawmakers made that change back in 2017. But you're right, they also did kind of change the title a little bit. So in the past, it's been called the Superintendent of Public Instruction. Under the law now, it will be the Education Secretary. So it's a little more similar now, I guess, to the way that, the federal government, the president, appoints someone to be the leader of the Department of Education there. And so Indiana's kind of taking that model down to the state level.
Okay, but the job will pretty much remain the same. What do we know about who would be in that role depending on who wins?
Right. So earlier this week, Dr. Woody Myers, the Democrat nominee for the governor's race, he said that he would appoint current superintendent of public instruction, Jennifer McCormick. They talked a little bit about that with reporters this week, and McCormick says she agreed to it because continuity is very important for schools right now, especially with the pandemic going on. And she announced she wouldn't seek re-election way back in 2018. So this is kind of a significant shift, but she says that the frustrations that prompted her to make that decision back in 2018, could potentially go away if leadership changes at the state level. So Dr. Woody Myers is going with Jennifer McCormick, and then Libertarian candidate Donald Rainwater announced this week as well that he would appoint a person named Dawn Wooten, and she actually faced off with Jennifer McCormick during the campaign, the race for the Republican nomination for the superintendent seat back in 2016. So there's some history there of McCormick and Wooten, kind of going against one another. And so those are the names that we have right now. Holcomb, Governor Eric Holcomb, he has said that, he's been hearing recommendations from people. People have been sending him names and suggestions, but he won't review those until after the election. So we've got two names right now, but Holcomb is still waiting to see, what the outcome is for November 3rd.
Has the Indiana State Teachers Association endorsed any of the gubernatorial candidates?
So far, no. They had their announcement a few weeks ago that they would not endorse any candidates for governor. And that's interesting. They usually do. But when I talked to them, I talked to ISTA, they said that the candidates so far had not said enough about, who they would choose for education secretary, kind of the vision for that position, that role. So I think it was a way to kind of add a little bit of pressure to that question because, reporters, I have been asking, as well as many others. So people have been really waiting to see kind of a short list or, a name come out. And now we have. So I'm not sure what their next move will be. But so far, the ISTA has not endorsed any candidate for governor. But the American Federation for Teachers, the other major union here in Indiana, they've actually endorsed Dr. Myers. And I think their national president even came to the state to also endorse Myers. So a couple levels there. But so far, ISTA, the largest union, has not.
Are they focused on any other races, the ISTA?
Yeah, that's a great question. They actually, the reasoning that they put forward for not endorsing anyone for governor is that they wanted to focus on the state house races. So, teachers, ISTA have been very vocal about the effect that, legislation has on education. And, over the years, there's been quite a bit of tension in the amount of legislation coming out of the state house focused on education and the type. So they really wanted to kind of emphasize those races for seats in the state house, members of the legislature, because they want those to be, pro public education people. So ISTA has been investing more time and money into those state house races, supporting educators who, are current ISTA members or maybe were former ISTA members. They don't even have to be ISTA members. They're talking about anybody who is pro public education. So that, could include someone from AFT up north. So, but yes, they're focusing more on the General Assembly.
Eric Weddle, education referendums have come up as a hot topic in the last few cycles. How many are on the ballots in Indiana this year?
Well, right now there's only going to be four on the November ballot, and I'm not going to say, I can tell you why, that's for sure, but I think there are a few issues at play for why there's so few, and I think from just my reading and talking to people, I think the main one is just there's so many referenda that have already passed. I mean, there's been 200 already on the ballot in the state, in the past years. A majority of those have passed. So many school districts who needed that money either got it or the voters didn't want it. So I think that's one reason. It's a presidential election. A lot of focus is on that race. But in 2016, there were more referenda. There were 10 on the ballot. In 2012, there were just three. So I think there's a lot of different issues why school districts would choose not to do it, this November.
Jeannie, what are the referendums we're looking at across the state this election?
Yeah, so this time around, there are, like Eric said, there's only four. Most of them are up north, but we do have one that's down in the southeast corner of the state. So just running through the list really quickly, there's Bremen Public Schools. There's Gary Community School Corporation. That's a pretty significant one. At Wawasee Community School Corporation, and then Southeast Du Bois County School Corporation. So the purpose is for those kind of range, you know, according to the filing information that, you know, is available online. Bremen Public Schools is focusing on health services, you know, hiring a school nurse and supporting student mental health. There's also Wawasee Community School Corporation. Their filing information says, you know, they want to focus on safety and security, adult education, and career tech ed. And then Southeast Du Bois, their filing info says they're focusing on school safety and mental health, recruiting and maintaining teachers, which sounds like teacher pay, and then supporting other educational programs in their schools.
Eric, you've done some reporting on what's happened up in Gary. Let's look at the high stakes of that referendum up there. What's going on up there? What do they want?
Well, I mean, most people now probably, you know, are aware that the Gary School District was taken over by the state because they were $100 million in debt and they had a $20 million annual operating budget deficit. You know, they basically could not manage to operate. So the state came in, hired a private company that's been there for a number of years now. And that company basically has decided that passing a referendum is going to help them, you know, increase revenue that they need to keep going. So they're asking for $71 million referenda. And some lawmakers up there are basically saying that, like, if this doesn't pass, you know, they're not sure the district will survive. If it does pass, it's going to show that, you know, the people in the community, they, you know, they want to help. They want to pay a little bit more money to help that school district. The company that's been running it, you know, they have been chipping away at that $20 million annual deficit. I think it's around $6 million now. So there are things that are happening up there in terms of improving the functioning of that district financially. But I think, yeah, this referendum is really going to say what the community thinks if they want to support it that way. And there is opposition right now that's organized that is against it passing.
We're talking about education issues at the ballot box this year across the state, and we have with us two education reporters, Jeannie Lindsay of Indiana Public Broadcasting and Eric Weddle from our flagship station WFYI in Indianapolis. So, Jeannie, there are a lot of reasons to choose one presidential candidate over another. On education, what distinguishes the Trump administration from a Biden presidency?
Well, in terms of K-12, I guess the most obvious way to kind of describe it is school choice at the federal level versus traditional public schooling. The Trump administration has clear priorities to expand choice and access to charter schools. You know, there's been that emphasis the entire time. And now, you know, in the campaign, that's a really strong emphasis as well. Trump has also included an emphasis on patriotic education in his plans, in direct contrast with the 1619 project from the New York Times. And as you could probably guess, Biden does not agree with a lot of that. In fact, he wants more oversight for charter schools and doesn't want those federally funded. And so that's just some examples at the K-12 level. And I'm less familiar with higher education, but the U.S. Department of Ed oversees, you know, student loans and that entire system. So, you know, what we've seen so far, the Trump administration has not really been favorable to forgiving student debt in a lot of cases, and has actually proposed cutting some federal student aid. And Biden, again, has kind of taken the opposite stance, I guess I would say. You know, he wants to cancel student debt for a lot of people. He's included in his, you know, campaigning plans up to $10,000 of student debt cancellation. And then also making, you know, two-year colleges and certificate programs free for people who want to do those. So very different approaches in terms of the choices, you know, at the K-12 level, and then how the handling and, you know, maintenance of the student loan system and the operation of that at the federal level. So there's definitely a lot more to say there, but there's definitely very clear distinctions in the different approaches of those candidates.
Eric Weddle, where I live, there are more signs for school board candidates than there are just about anything else.
Right.
I mean, it's probably it's a reflection of how many candidates there are and how much, I guess, how much money they get. When we look at some of the big issues that these school districts are trying to address, what stands out?
Well, I think right now the issue of the pandemic is at the forefront just in terms of what candidates are talking about. And that can be the decisions and how they're going to decide whether to be in school or out of school, how they're going to deal with, you know, the funding shortfall. I think everybody is expecting of some sort, or just how to pay for everything. So the pandemic, you know, is definitely one of the big issues. And, you know, I've heard from some state level educators, they're just wondering, is there going to be a lot of turnover in boards because some people may not be happy with how their local school district dealt with the pandemic. Another issue I've been looking at, though, is issue of racial equity and anti-racism, which, you know, we saw happen this summer in terms of the racial justice protests. And that has, you know, gotten its way into a lot of school board races in the state in a way that's never happened before that I'm, you know, aware of happening. So I think there's a lot of candidates who are the first time are talking about different types of disparities in their district, whether it be in discipline or funding or access, or in the type of teachers that they hire. You know, the majority of teachers in Indiana are white, and a lot of districts want to change that. So I think that is one of the most emerging issues, and really for some candidates, probably the biggest focus for them right now in trying to discuss how they will address that.
I would imagine that that's a bit of a universal concern. Couldn't that be handled at the state level?
Sure. I mean, there are definitely policies the state could hand down, you know, to address some of those issues, you know, maybe in terms of discipline or maybe in terms of how funding is used or is distributed. But I think that would really, you know, that would take away from the local control the state has always kind of wanted to give to school districts. But at the same time, these local elected boards, they're the ones who can do it fastest. They're being elected. They can work with their superintendent and the administration at that local level. And, you know, they can decide a change that goes into effect right away.
Eric, are there districts we can point to that have specifically said they want to address these equity issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Indianapolis Public Schools has made it an issue for them before this election started. So, you know, those issues are being discussed among candidates. But I think what's been interesting is up in West Lafayette School District, the alumni up there this summer wrote a letter addressing many issues that they said they have seen in the school district, whether it's the how students of color are treated, the curriculum that is used. And it got a huge amount of support from other alumni. 800 alumni from that high school signed on to it from the school district. And it's really forced this conversation with the candidates up there that are running for a number of seats. And this alumni group has even gone forth and endorsed the candidates who have agreed to try and implement their plan to bring equity and anti-racism into West Lafayette schools. So I think it's interesting how the issue is coming up in other school districts. We've seen it's being addressed because students have taken it upon themselves to make social media accounts and anonymously discuss issues at the district. But West Lafayette, it's been very open conversation and very blunt with what the people want to see changed and how the candidates will address it.
Jeannie Lindsay, you did some reporting on school inequity. What's being pointed to as a possible reason for this inequity?
Yeah, so it's hard to, you know, pinpoint a single reason for something as broad as, you know, equity. But one of the things that always comes up when I ask about it in its many forms is funding. And for some schools, that's been a challenge more than others, especially, you know, with changes the state has made to how it funds schools over the past decade. I reported on a study just last week or the week before. Time is kind of a blur right now. But it was talking about, you know, the way that Indiana's funding model is, you know, affecting gaps, you know, funding gaps on the line of, you know, community wealth, you know, income status, and then also race. So there are a few reasons, like those changes that I mentioned, you know, the property tax caps, and then changing what's called the complexity index, which is how the state calculates need-based funding. And so the changes to the formula itself, but then in addition to, you know, changes in the landscape of education in Indiana. So, you know, charters have grown significantly, their presence in the state, you know, obviously voucher schools, private schools, you know, that whole area has grown a lot, but also referendum funding. You know, we've seen a lot of referendum proposals, you know, in the past decade or so after the tax caps came into effect. And so, you know, this report really looked at all of the different layers of changes that have really kind of made the difference in, you know, how much money high wealth communities have versus, you know, low wealth communities. That gap has just gotten wider. And then the way that the schools who, you know, serve a lot of students, a lot of children of color, you know, those are not always funded the exact same way, especially if you look at the charter divide. You know, charter schools serve a lot of students of color just as a makeup of their schools, but they also can't access property tax dollars the way that, you know, traditional public school corporations can. So there's just a, you know, kind of a difference in the way that things have evolved over time. And, you know, obviously every school's effort to make, you know, education more equitable looks different, but really when it comes down to it, funding and the way that schools are funded in Indiana is a huge factor.
Eric Weddle, speaking of school board races, are there some that are getting far more support than others?
Yeah, you know, Indianapolis Public Schools in Marion County, we are seeing a lot of money that is going into that race. So far, political action committees have put $200,000 into the four races to be on the IPS school board. We mentioned ISTA's political action committee earlier. They've put $11,000 into one candidate. And you're seeing kind of the money is being divided between the candidates who are in support of the current administration and their reforms that are going on here, most notably the collaboration with charter schools and having charter school operators come in to improve or restart current schools, and the candidates who are against that or are very critical of some of the other reforms the district is doing right now.
Eric Weddle is the education reporter from our flagship station, WFYI Indianapolis. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
Jeannie Lindsay reports on education for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Jeannie, thank you.
Oh, yeah, anytime.
Coming up, depression and anxiety is exacerbated by colder and shorter days under normal circumstances. We'll hear from a Side Effects Public Media reporter on how much worse seasonal affective disorder will be this year. Plus, an Indiana brewery won big at the so-called Oscars of Beer. That's next in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. How's your mental health? Many of us are pretty strained in that area these days, but for some, it's a serious clinical problem. Depression and anxiety can ramp up this time of year, even during normal circumstances, as the weather gets colder and the days get shorter. But with the added variable that we're in a global pandemic and our in-person social circles are much smaller, those mental health issues can be made that much worse. Side Effects Public Media's Darian Benson has been reporting on this, and she joins us now. Hi, Darian.
Hi, Matt.
So what are we talking about? I guess, what do many people think we're talking about?
Yeah, so I've spoken with a few mental health experts, and they hypothesize that as we have seen an increase in those who experience mental health this past summer and this past spring, they hypothesize that we will see an even bigger increase as we enter those colder months, you know, fall and winter, with those who experience seasonal affective disorder, also known by its acronym SAD, S-A-D, as well as an increase in general anxiety and depression.
That is an apt acronym, SAD. Do we know the difference, though, between seasonal affective disorder and clinical anxiety and depression, or can they work hand in hand?
Yeah, seasonal affective disorder, it happens when there is a shift in seasons, spring and summer into winter and fall. Also, sometimes you see an increase in seasonal affective disorder during winter into spring. But it's normally, you know, as we enter the colder months and people just start to feel like negative mood changes, it can cause depression symptoms like feeling lethargic, or someone might not take interest in hobbies they normally would. Experts hypothesize that this is due to our natural clock kind of getting off course due to the shorter days. So our bodies just aren't kind of in tune with that. Whereas clinical depression and anxiety are more year-round, sometimes they can be long-term, but we definitely see this happening at the same time. I asked the question to psychologists, and they said that it's hard to pinpoint kind of what demographics or who's more prone to feeling seasonal affective disorder, but those who are already more inclined to experience anxiety and depression are more at risk.
How has anxiety and depression been worsened by the pandemic?
You know, this is a major global stressor. There are financial hardships as businesses close or people might be getting laid off. People aren't able to travel as often and see friends and family as often as they used to. Thousands of Americans are getting sick and dying, and these are taking a toll on people's mental health. One psychologist I spoke with, Dr. Kevin Rand from IUPUI, he said that this has really created a perfect storm for depression and anxiety.
So those who have felt like they've experienced depression but maybe haven't been diagnosed could be headed down that road. Is that what I'm hearing? That some of these symptoms may make their way from, I think I have depression, to it actually becoming a clinical problem?
Yes, exactly that. A lot of people who may be even feeling these symptoms for the first time, it might be getting worse now. And everyone I spoke with said, you know, if you do get that feeling that it's getting a little bit worse and that maybe you can't handle it on your own, definitely reach out to a medical provider to see if there's any help. Another psychologist I spoke with said in her clinical practice, she has seen an increase in symptoms in her patients over the course of the pandemic, but expects it to be much worse as we head into winter and as that seasonal depression starts to set in. She also said that with some patients, new symptoms of anxiety have started to manifest. So maybe they've been dealing with maybe general anxiety before, but now those symptoms have kind of shifted and it might be like intensifying or just new symptoms and triggers might be happening.
So new anxiety, like what?
Well, actually, one source I spoke with has been in therapy for social anxiety over the past few years, and she's learned to kind of adapt to what her previous symptoms were. But now, since the pandemic, her anxiety has kind of shifted from the general social anxiety to something that almost looks like agoraphobia. So grocery stores are now starting to trigger anxiety. She said being around people in unknown places where maybe someone isn't wearing a mask has been really difficult, but now she's learning techniques and therapy to help her out with these new symptoms and triggers.
What about treatments? What are some of the ways that people are mitigating this? Some people use medication, of course, but what else is recommended?
Yeah, so some things that experts recommend is making sure you are getting the right amount of sleep you need this winter. So not too much and not too little, as that can kind of increase depressive symptoms. Getting exercise, even when it's cold, even if it's just a walk down your street or a few jumping jacks in your living room. And then social interaction, which is a little hard as we are told to social distance, but that could look like a phone call to a friend or maybe a Zoom call or another video call with some family members. And also just remembering that just like this pandemic will eventually be over, so will spring, and hopefully that will alleviate some of that seasonal depression.
And I've also heard that there is, this is not intuitive to me. I would not think that this would be a treatment, but there's light therapy that's recommended. What does this look like?
Yeah, so one of the experts I spoke with recommends getting a light box. He said you can get them at places like Amazon or other online retailers, and it's just a small box, maybe the size of a vanity mirror or like a notebook that you can keep it on your desk, turn it on. It has really powerful light that kind of stimulates this artificial sunlight, and you just leave it on for maybe half an hour, and that can kind of help you.
There's been a lot of talk about the healthcare system being overloaded because of COVID. Are mental health professionals concerned about their ability to meet all these potential new needs?
Yeah. So mental health professionals are a bit concerned. They've already seen an uptick in mental health symptoms during the course of the pandemic. The CDC actually did a study and found that between April and June, 40% of adults that they surveyed had seen a rise in their either depression, anxiety, or substance use symptoms. So they're kind of worried that as we head into winter and anxiety and depression and other things are already on the rise, that they're going to be even worse this winter. But they also said don't hesitate to reach out if you do need some more professional help.
Darian Benson is a reporter for Side Effects Public Media, which is a public health news collaborative based at our flagship station, WFYI, in Indianapolis. Darian, thanks.
Thank you.
And now for some good news about Indiana beer. 1 week ago, the winners of this year's Great American Beer Festival Awards were announced live at a virtual event in Denver, Colorado. Indiana breweries took home 10 medals, including 2 gold medals. But the brewery with the most medals nationwide was Indianapolis-based Sun King Brewery. Joining me now is co-founder and CEO Clay Robinson. Clay, congratulations.
Hey, thank you very much, Matt.
And in the interest of disclosure, I should probably say that Sun King is a sponsor of our flagship station WFYI in Indianapolis. So, Clay, How many beers did you enter this year?
So we entered beers from our downtown brewery and our Fisher's brewery. So we had two breweries entered in the brewery group of the year for a total of 19 different beers to get judged.
Which ones won then?
So we got a gold medal for Afternoon Delight, which is a bourbon barrel aged Doppelbock, and the second time that it has won a gold medal in the last handful of years.
Two golds? Not in a row, though, right?
No, not in a row. I think the last medal, it was in 2013, it won a gold medal. So then we got a bronze medal for Cherry Busey, which is actually the fourth time that it has won a GABF medal. And I think it's won all of the various varieties over the past like 4 years. So that's a pretty big win for us. And then Sunlight Cream Ale, which is our flagship number one best-selling beer, might as well be the unofficial official beer of the state of Indiana. That got a bronze medal this year. And 2 years ago, 2 to 3 years ago, it got a gold medal. So that's its second GABF medal. And then we won a bronze medal for Pachanga, our Mexican style lager, which is the everyone who works at Sun King beer drinking everyday favorite.
So that's the staff favorite then.
It is.
Why is that? I mean, what do people like about that one?
Well, in the earlier days, Osiris was actually the favorite in general. And I think a lot of our folks around here like hoppy beers. But in general, as you're in the beer industry for longer and longer, something about you gravitates back towards just really crisp. Like we call them crushable or sessionable beers, but Pachanga is super, super nice. It's easy to drink. It's a beer for everybody. It's the kind of beer that, you know, you can give to your mother, brother, cousin, or uncle, and who's a beer drinker, and it tastes like beer. It's like very good beer.
I've got one here. The brewery sent me one, which I'm very thankful for. That's very nice of you. Let's give it a try. Pachanga. Tomato, tomato, I guess.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I think Pachanga is probably the appropriate, but in Indiana, we call it Pachanga.
Okay. That is great. That's like a post-lawn mowing beer.
Yeah, it is. It won in the light lager category, so it's probably the most traditional beer-like beer that we make. I think probably one of the coolest things about it or most interesting things is that when we originally created that beer, we created it for our 7th anniversary. Our brewing team got together and decided they wanted to make a light lager. They wanted to make a lager that they could drink every day and would be super delicious in the hot summer sun, and that we wanted to make a Mexican style lager. So our team went out, and Kevin, who runs our quality program, went out and got all of the available Mexican lagers in our market. And then we do a robust sensory panel, and everyone tasted different beers. So basically we ran all of these beers through our sensory panel, and everybody kind of picked them apart and said, I like this about this, I don't like this, these are things that we love. And then we basically designed a recipe around a flavor profile of our team and created this beer for our 7th anniversary that we just called Siete. And we brewed a batch, and it was everyone's favorite beer that summer.
And so then, but now it's a house beer, right? How did it make its way on into that status?
A gradual evolution. So everyone loved it so much for our 7th anniversary that we decided for the following summer we were going to bring it back around. But now we were 8, and there's already a Siete Brewing Company somewhere in the world, so we needed to rename it. And in our naming lexicon, we actually spent a lot of time on the internet going down rabbit holes, and we stumbled upon Pachanga as kind of a Hispanic slang word that means a gathering of family, friends with food and beverages, often live music or music, and essentially a Pachanga is a party. So no one had ever made a beer called Pachanga before. We do all the searches for trademarks, and no one had ever made a Pachanga before. So we went with Pachanga. We brought it out as a summer seasonal, and then at the end of summer, we all still loved it, and a lot of the staff kind of lobbied for it. I spent about 6 months trying to convince my partner and our sales team and other people that this was a beer that we should make year round. And then finally, I finally won the battle, and or we won the battle, and we decided to make it year round. So by the time we turned 9, 2 years after it was actually first brewed, it became a beer that we made every single day, day in and day out.
And now it's solidified as a medal winner at the Great American Beer Festival.
Yeah, it was a big win for us because, again, everyone on the staff loves Pechanga. So to see that beer win, get recognition for being one of the best beers of its style is a really big honor.
What else is going on with Sun King lately? I've heard something about an airport location.
Yeah, I mean, we got a lot going on. It's been an interesting year for sure. We have a location that opens at the Indianapolis International Airport that's kind of been in the works for a few years now. It was supposed to open in March of 2020, March 14th to be exact.
And, wow, that's terrible timing.
Terrible timing. It was completely built out. It was ready to go. And they left the walls up around it and said, hey, people aren't traveling. We can't open the spot and we're just going to wait. And so maybe a month or so ago, we started having some conversations about how airplane traffic was picking up and the airport was getting a little busier and people were going to be traveling for fall break and people are buying tickets for the holidays and that, hey, there might be enough traffic to actually get that thing up and opening. So we're doing it.
You've been canning your beer since you started back in 2009, which I guess was unusual at that time because most craft beers were found in bottles then. And we can get into the benefits of canning over bottling if you want. But I understand right now there's an aluminum shortage. Has that been hard on you?
Yeah, it's definitely something. I mean, like I said, 2020 has been full of exciting new challenges and pivots and worked through a lot of changes. And gradually, without bars and restaurants, our volume kind of continued to grow, and it grew in through grocery and liquor stores through selling cans of beer. So as that grew back, we finally got back to a point in time where 2020 was kind of leveling out. And then we got word that it's actually not a shortage of aluminum. It's a shortage of runtime at can plants. So we have dubbed it, or it has been dubbed, the candemic. And essentially there is not enough runtime at aluminum plants. We buy all of our cans from the Ball Corporation, which has a plant in Monticello, Indiana. So all our cans are made in Indiana and we purchase those and we can't get any more. And it gets a little bit difficult because in August of 2019, we bought 500,000 aluminum cans total from Ball. In August of 2020, we bought 1.2 million cans. So our can volume more than doubled in the course of a year because of everything that's going on in the world. And that's actually not specific to Sun King. There've been a ton of breweries. We were an early adopter of cans, but there've been a lot of breweries who used to be exclusively bottles who have moved to cans. There are a lot of new breweries with no draft presence. A lot of smaller breweries have moved to mobile canning. So that, in light of seltzers becoming a popular thing, and seltzers have grown like 300% year after year. So just more and more product is going into cans and more of it's being sold in grocery stores. And that puts pressure on the rest of the supply chain in a similar way that we've seen throughout the rest of the natural world this year.
I want to close by talking about this camaraderie in the beer industry. To a degree, you're all in competition with each other, but it seems like you're all still willing to help each other out as well. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I mean, beer is a pretty friendly and social thing. You know, back when I started brewing 21 years ago, my partner Dave's been brewing in Indiana for over 23 years. At that point in time, there were a handful of breweries and we knew everybody in the state. And as it's grown, we don't necessarily know everyone in the state anymore, but it's a friendly industry. I mean, we get together over beers. Everybody has their different festivals or events. And generally speaking, we all get along pretty well. And we try to help each other out. You know, at a point in time, we actually used our canning line to can beer for St. Joseph's down the road so that they could actually get some of the beer that they'd produced out and be selling beer when they were having, you know, their tap room and their restaurants shuttered. Our lab does lab work for breweries around the state. So if somebody's got a beer that needs to be examined, or they think there might be something wrong, or they just want the statistics on it, we will run it through our sensory panel. We'll run it through our science team, and we'll give them answers or help them try to figure things out. So it's kind of been in the history. I mean, brewing's been around for so long. And, you know, if we lived in the 1800s, there'd be a handful of brewers in the town and we'd all share a brewery and we'd work together. And that kind of feeling and spirit that is the basis of brewing beer still lives on today. And it's one of the things that actually makes our industry so special and such a great industry to be a part of.
Clay Robinson is co-founder and CEO of Sun King Brewing in Indianapolis, and they won the most medals of any brewery nationwide at last weekend's virtual Great American Beer Festival. Clay, congrats again.
Thanks, Matt.
Other Indiana breweries who won last weekend were Taxman Brewing Company in Bargersville, Moontown Brewing Company in Whitestown, Flicks Brewhouse in Carmel, and Metazoa Brewing Company in Indianapolis. Our congratulations to all of them as well. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. For topic alerts and discussion, I'm Matt Pelzer. Cheers. This is All In.